Okay, so I am kind of going to start the way the outline is, but the first, I'm just going to give a little illustration to get us started, but where I'm going is starting with our identity, and that's tied to Jesus, the person of Jesus, and then talking about the false teachers and just the error in their ways that Paul points out and how we can heed his warning about false teachings and just application for us as a church and then maybe even individually how we might be specifically prone to certain false teachings. So I'm going to start with a quote from the movie The Family Man. I don't know if anyone's seen it. It's one of my favorites. It's kind of set around Christmas time, and it's with Nicolas Cage and Tia Leone, and Nicolas Cage is this really wealthy, very selfish, single, successful man, and he's given this glimpse into a life that would be if he hadn't broken up with his like college sweetheart, and if they had stayed together and had a family, and what that would look like. So this quote is from the end of the movie. So I'm sorry if you haven't seen it. It's going to give away the ending. But it's the end of the movie, and so the glimpse is over. So he's returned to his life in New York, like his high, rich life. And he finds Kate, who is his college sweetheart. And he tracks her down, and she's in an airport, and she's getting ready to board a plane to Paris. So that's kind of to catch you up where this quote is. So Nicolas Cage in the movie, his name is Jack. So this is how he starts. He says, "We have a house in Jersey. We have two kids, Annie and Josh. Annie's not much of a violin player, but she tries real hard. She's a little precocious, but that's only because she says what's on her mind and when she smiles. And Josh, he has your eyes. He doesn't say much, but we know he's smart. He's always got his eyes open. He's always watching us. Sometimes you look at him, and you just know he's learning something new. It's like witnessing a miracle. The house is a mess, but it's ours. After 122 more payments, it's going to be ours. And you're a nonprofit lawyer. That's right. You're completely nonprofit. But that doesn't seem to bother you. And we're in love. After 13 years of marriage, we're still unbelievably in love. You won't even let me touch you until I've said it. I sing to you. Not all of the time, but definitely on special occasions. We've dealt with our share of surprises and made a lot of sacrifices, but we've stayed together. You see, you're a better person than I am, and it made me a better person to be around you. I don't know, maybe it was all just a dream. Maybe I went to bed one lonely night in December, and I imagined all of it. But I swear, nothing has ever felt more real. And if you get on that plane right now, I'll disappear forever. I know we could both go on with our lives, and we'd be fine. But I've seen what we could be like together, and I choose us. Please, Kate, one cup of coffee. You can always go to Paris. Just please not tonight." So, I really like this quote because I think that Jack is like painting this picture of what their identity is together, and he's saying that that's what I want, this is what I want my identity to be, and I want it to be in you. And I like that it's a person, because that's what Paul is telling us in this letter to the Colossians in chapter 2. He's telling the Colossians, remember who you are in Jesus and who your identity is tied to. And so it's kind of, I'm stretching it a little bit, but Paul is painting this picture for the Colossians that's real, so it's not a glimpse, but of what their identity is in Jesus, in this full, beautiful identity that Christ has given to us. So if you like that quote, you can watch the movie. It's really good. So then just, I kind of touched on it already, but Christ is a person, and that's who our identity is tied to. So we're not... it's not this religious system. It's not these rules. And that's what Paul is warning the Colossians against, that we are tied to the person of Jesus. So that's important to know, that it's a person and not a system. And so I just want to go into the kind of beginning verses there, from verses 6 to 15, where Paul is describing who Jesus is and who we are in him. And I'm going to read the verses, and I'm going to read them slowly, because I want to give us time and space to just sit in the truth of who Jesus is and who we are in him. Because I could just read these verses and go sit down. You don't need my thoughts and my borrowed interpretations, that this word, God's word, is sufficient, and that it is good for us to rest in it. So I'm just going to go ahead and read it. You can follow along if you want to, or you can just listen. So I'm going to start in verse 6. As you received Christ Jesus as Lord, so walk in him. For in him, the whole fullness of deity dwells bodily. And as you have been filled in him, who is the head of all rule and authority, in him also you are circumcised, with a circumcision made without hands, but putting off the body of the flesh by circumcision of Christ. Having been buried with him in baptism, in which you were also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God, who raised him from the dead. And you, who were dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh, God made alive together with him, having forgiven our trespasses, conceding the record of debt that stood against us with its legal demands. He disarmed the rulers and authorities and put them to open shame by triumphing over them in him. So I just hope that those words can wash over you, and that they're going to give you rest today, and rest in your life in Jesus, that your identity isn't changing, that it's secure in what Jesus has done for you. So reading through these commentaries and this passage, it makes me think of our justification that Paul is talking about, what's been done, what is secure, and our identity doesn't wax and wane with our sanctification, so our walk with Jesus, that our identity is always secure in him, and it's not based on feelings or how we think we're doing, but it's based on the person of Jesus, and that doesn't change. So we always get to go back to that place. We don't have to live in a world where our identity is ever changing, because it is secure. So I'm just going to flesh out a few of those verses, not all of them, but a few, because some of the wording's kind of different and not how we talk. In verse 11, Paul talks about circumcision. In our Bible study, Kathleen Nielsen talked about this a little bit too, but I just thought it was worth highlighting again, that this use of circumcision was a marking of God's people. It was a bodily marking, and it was a sign of the covenant. So it was showing that, a visible sign that these people are set apart, that they're God's people. And we are no longer, because of Christ and his fulfillment of the Old Testament laws, we're no longer bound to circumcision. Or I should say, men are no longer bound to circumcision, but that's because we are circumcised in our heart through Jesus, who imparts his righteousness to us. And so I just think that sometimes the idea of marking can get lost, because it's not a visible sign anymore, but Jesus is still marking us as his, and he's setting us aside, that we are special, and that he calls us his own. So I think that that's comforting too, that you are loved, and chosen. And I have this quote, I think I put it on y'all's handout. Yes, by Matt Chandler. He said, "My identity is made because I have been called, not because of my own righteousness, but because of God's righteousness. And he has called me his own and marked me out." So just kind of further illustrating that idea of circumcision that Paul's talking about. And then if you want to look at verse 12, he talks about being buried with Christ and with him in baptism, and then also raised with him through faith in the powerful working of God. So N.T. Wright said that this is the idea that we're being transferred from the old solidarity to the new solidarity. So we're putting off our sinful nature, and we're no longer slaves to our sin, that we are walking in righteousness, that we are slaves to Christ's righteousness. And he, N.T. Wright kind of used the language of like entering into the family of God. And then these last verses all kind of tie together. So verse 13, or the last verses in this section, verse 13 talks about that you're dead in your trespasses and the uncircumcision of your flesh. And if you look at Ephesians 2:12, I didn't put this on your handout, sorry. It's just a cross-reference here, but it says that, remember that you were at that time separated from Christ, alienated from the commonwealth of Israel and the strangers to the covenant of the promise, having no hope without God in the world. So just further illustration of what we are apart from Christ, how we're dead in our trespasses. And these final two verses in 14 and 15 talk about the two barriers that we have between us and God. So the barrier of our own sin, which is in the law that we're guilty, and then also the other barrier of the forces of evil that Paul talks about in this letter, these rulers and authorities, these powers. And John Piper talked or had this quote about Christ, what he did in his death and resurrection with the rulers and authorities. So he says, "The devil was disarmed. Why? Because the weapon of accusation was taken out of his hand. He always waved that record of debt in our face in God's court, but now that's canceled. The devil is disarmed. He can huff and puff, but he cannot damn you." So I think the word accusation, that's Satan's tool that he can use against you, but he can't anymore because of Jesus, that your slate has been wiped clean and that Jesus has taken the penalty for your sins. So again, just reiterating our identity in Jesus, that this is where our identity is secure, that we're secure in him. And that means that he has transformed our hearts, that he owns us, that the authority that was given to him has been given to us, that he has canceled all of our debt, that in him we live, move, and have our being. So we are forever tied to Jesus. So that's what Jesus has done for us, and just want to rest in that and find our identity in that and start there, because Paul, this is the first place in Colossians in chapter 2 where he's moving from the indicative to the imperative, so he's giving a command, and it's that first, first verses in Colossians 2 that Kathleen Nielsen calls the main verses of Colossians, where he's saying walk in him, be built up in him, rooted in him. But that it's so important to see how Paul, again, starts with who Jesus is instead of calling us what to do. And then if you read the rest of chapter 2, it's really not that many instructions. It's a lot of don't do this, but he doesn't give all of these rules and things that we need to do. So just finding our freedom, again, that Paul is saying, your identity is Jesus. It's not what you can do for him, what you can do for the church. That this is where we rest. So So that's important moving into the next section when he's talking about the false teachers. And I just kind of want to go over briefly the characteristics of the false teachers just to help us get an idea of what they're like and then how that applies to us and how we can be on guard against that. So verses 16 and 17, Paul is talking about these teachers that are requiring to keep these religious observances or to probably kind of fasting or abstaining from some kind of food or drink. So they're saying, you need to do this in order to be more spiritual, in order to spiritually grow. And they're basically adding this to salvation. So it's kind of like a Jesus plus. And Paul is reminding us that God is concerned with our hearts, that it's not this outward appearance of the actions, or solely this outward appearance of actions that we are doing. But also, it's important to see the connection between this and Judaism. So these, especially the new moon, these are Jewish observances, festivals, and so they're taking what Christ has already fulfilled, what he's come and fulfilled in the law, and they're just like scooting it over to our Christian world now and saying these also apply here, but they've already been fulfilled, so they're not required any longer. And to say that they're required for Christianity is adding to salvation and leading these people astray that are following them. So he, and just to kind of like highlight Paul's language here, he talks about shadow and substance. So he's saying these things are a shadow. They're nothing. They don't have value. They don't have weight. Where following Christ and being secure in your salvation in Jesus, that's what has substance. That's what matters. That's what is important. And then moving to the next teaching false teaching that he talks about in 18 through 19, there's some like crazy language there when he talks about worship of angels and asceticism, which I just went ahead and defined that. I wasn't totally sure what it meant. So if you didn't know either, it's a severe self-discipline and avoidance of all forms of indulgence for religious reasons. So this language makes me think of the Pharisees a little bit, and just how it was all outward, that they were showing how holy they were, that they were super spiritual and set apart, kind of like this elite spiritual group, and making it so that it was hard to obtain that. And that's not what the gospel is. So N.T. Wright tells us that while the false teaching might try to exclude the Colossians from membership in the gospel, in reality, it is they, not the Colossians, who are in danger of being excluded. So Jesus didn't come and say, some of you are kind of saved and some of you are saved, and like this is the hierarchy. But he came and Jews and Gentiles, he redeemed. So there isn't this spiritual elite group that you have to follow these teachings, and you need to have this certain vision or these certain reasons or logic in order to follow Jesus, in order to really be a mature Christian. And I think just to kind of like side note, the worship of angels, I was just reading that it's not necessarily that they were like worshiping like a picture of angels or something, but that they had spent so much time trying to understand what angels do and their role, that it was as if they were worshiping angels because they spent little time on Jesus, that they were highlighting angels in a way that the Bible doesn't highlight, in a way they're like lifting them to this level that they're not at, that because angels aren't going to give us salvation. They're not going to save us. They're agents of God. So, and then the final section, Kathleen Nielsen calls a final warning against regulations based simply on human precepts and teachings. So I thought that there is two words that Paul uses that were important in that last section, and it's the very last verse when he says that these teachings have the appearance of wisdom. So they look good. That it's not, I think that when I think of false teachings, I'm like, oh, it's coming from Hollywood or, you know, just like really worldly places. But that should key us in that it can come from the church, that it's coming from the inside, and it's not necessarily these things that you would think are, that on the surface, they're not bad. They're not bad things, but they become idols when we add them to what Christ has required in salvation, or what God has required in salvation, and then therefore requiring it of other Christians, and especially new Christians, saying, you're saved, but this also needs to happen in order for you to be mature in Christ. And that's what Paul is warning against in the Colossians, in this new church that's sitting in a world that is being infiltrated by these like pagan and Judaism ideas. And he's trying to remind them to hold strong in what and who they are in Jesus, and that they don't need these false promises that they'll be more spiritual if they do this or follow this teaching, that they are already secure. So, application. I think it's good to ask ourselves, how are we tempted to follow teachings that have the appearance of wisdom? And what are we tempted, like, what in our hearts are we tempted to believe that should be added to salvation? So what are our idols that can kind of whisper in our heads and that we believe these voices? And so it could be somebody actually saying it, but I think it can also be these old habits that we have, maybe, that we've brought into Christianity, that these teachings that are just hard to let go of. It doesn't, you know, you become a Christian, but it doesn't like erase your past. So the ways that you cope and deal with life, or just what you've been maybe brought up in the church with, and maybe some false teachings that you were founded on from the beginning, and you're kind of unlearning them. So I kind of came up with two things, and I put them on your handout of works and reputation, and I'll just flesh it out a little bit. I think I'm a little more tempted towards reputation, but definitely works too. Got a lot of, pretty good at sinning, so I've got a lot of areas. So I think for the church, especially in a new church like ours, it's probably good to mention works, because there's a temptation that if you serve a lot, you're really holy, or that you're extra spiritual. And there's a temptation to want other people to see your service and what you've done, and that feels good to be recognized and to be really humble and servant-hearted. So that we need to be on guard for that, and on guard for even elevating people in a way that we shouldn't, when they're just humans, and that we're all struggling with sin in different ways, and that they can't carry the weight of our salvation. And I mean, you know, we can't carry our own weight of salvation. To just be reminded that our salvation isn't tied to our works and what we're doing, but to do it out of a love for Jesus instead of out of a need to identify ourselves and to put our self-worth in something. And then the second one, I think, for me, or the biggest one, is this appearance of having it all together. So, like, putting my reputation on how I appear to you and what I think you think of me. So it's this idea of, like, if my marriage isn't a mess, like, in front of you, and if my child isn't having a meltdown, like, in the middle of church and everyone can hear, and if I don't let all of my insecurities show, then, like, things are good. And when you ask me how I'm doing, I can be like, I'm good, because nothing looks bad. But to be, like, I start to feel insecure and, like, messy and needy when that starts to unravel, when it's, like, obvious that, like, Ryan and I are in a fight because we're not talking to each other. I'm just, like, giving him dirty looks or whatever it is, that, like, our marriage is in a hard spot, or that, like, you know, Shepherd yesterday in Walmart just, like, totally had a meltdown, and it's, you know, like, everyone's looking at you, and you are just letting, like, him cry in the aisle because that's what he was gonna do. So, yeah, but just, like, exposing that, it makes me feel insecure because my idol is approval, and it's just wanting people to, like, think well of me and wanting to be secure in, like, your opinion of me and not in Jesus, and not that we have the total freedom in Jesus to be parents of children that are a disaster, or, you know, in that moment, or, like, have a marriage that's really struggling, or personally just not be in a good place, be struggling with severe anxiety or depression, that those things don't change our identity. So personally, I just feel that I put a lot of my self-worth in my appearance to others, and a lot of that, and there's, like, other idols going on in there, and one of them is definitely control, but it's also, like, self-sufficiency, that I don't want to really depend on community. Like, I'm fine helping other people, but I don't really want to, like, ask for help myself. I don't want to have to admit that that I need it, like, all the time. So maybe that helps stir kind of some thoughts for you too, of just idols that you can start to elevate in a place where they cannot hold your salvation and they cannot define you and give you your self-worth. And the last thing that I wanted to say was just that, So the last thing I wanted to say is just, I said we a lot, and maybe that made you uncomfortable. Maybe you're not in a place where you feel like you're a Christian, or you are just wrestling with doubts. Whatever form that might be, doubts of Christianity or doubts in Jesus. And I just wanted to ask you to consider the fullness of the person of Jesus and not all of the rules and regulations that we so often see, like, in church when we walk in. But to just think about Jesus and what it would be like for your identity to be secure in him. And like Matt Chandler was saying, not because of your righteousness, but because of his.